Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wes Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wesexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 132. Unquiet Spirits.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, welcome back once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And our spirits will not be unquieted, folks. They are making us speak, you know, straight from the bottle, as it were.
Yes, the tables are rattling. The ectoplasm is forming. There's plenty of spirits around here.
Yes, yes. Well, they say that, all you need to have a Sherlockian meeting is two Sherlockians and a bottle. And in a pinch, you can dispense with one of the Sherlockians. Well, we're going to find out in today's episode that you don't want to dispense with that bottle, for God's sake. Keep it around, because there's a lot of history there, a lot of intrigue, and a lot of adventure. And, of course, you are here for audio adventures, for the delightful conversation, the scintillating conversation between us. And if you'd like to let us know what you think, please feel free to get in touch. We are available at ihearofsherlock.com. You can find the show notes for this episode at ihose.co/ihose132, all lowercase, ihose.co/ihose132. You can reach us on social media as I Hear of Sherlock in all of the locations, on Facebook, on the Twitters, on the Gram. And you can reach us by email, comment@ihearofsherlock.com, and get those fingers ready to dial, because you can reach us via the phone. We are 774-221-7323. That's 774-221-READ.
Yeah. And pretty soon, you know, I don't want to jump the gun looking ahead too far, but pretty soon you can find us on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner, on Blitzen, because we will be attached to your nearest sleigh as we scoot along the snowbanks into your ears.
Tis the season. It's the season. And if you feel like it, feel free to drop a buck or two in the tip jar for us at PayPal or Patreon to show us how much you appreciate what it is that we do here. Well, we are delighted to, before we get delighted, we actually have to get delighted about this.
The ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex is working to build our economy. We're introducing a stock market, but we're not sure how many of our ne'er-do-wells should be locked up in public pillories. While we dust the market square, you can enjoy Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers, Volume 3, edited by Matthias Bostrom and Matt Laffey. These newly discovered stories for the last 6 months of 1893 show Conan Doyle, the celebrated author, lecturing on English literature. and they report the presumed death of Sherlock Holmes at the Reichenbach Falls. Available right now at our WessexPress.com. Friends, it's November. Over the river and through the woods, trot fast, my dapple gray. Spring over the ground like a hunting hound on this Thanksgiving Day. Before your family gathers, reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
And as if that isn't enough to be excited and delighted about, we are delighted to welcome back to the program Bonnie McBird, who's a member of the Baker Street Irregulars and an author. And, of course, you may remember Bonnie from a previous episode here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. She was episode 83, where she talked with us about her first book, Art in the Blood. And now, of course, she is back with another novel called Unquiet Spirits, Whiskey, Ghosts, Murder. December of 1889, and fresh from debunking a ghostly hound in Dartmoor, we all know that story, Sherlock Holmes returned to London. And of course, he's greeted by a beautiful client who arrives with a tale of ghosts, kidnapping, and dynamite on a whiskey estate. Where else but Scotland? And, of course, you get Brother Mycroft coming up with an urgent assignment in the south of France. And there, on the fabled Riviera, Holmes and Watson encounter treachery, explosions, good old French detective rival Jean Vidocq, who you may remember from Art in the Blood, and a terrible discovery. Wow, this gives them reason to get northward to those snowy highlands in Scotland, where they experience a haunted castle among the copper dinosaurs of a great whiskey distillery, and where they and their young client face mortal danger. Of course, Holmes comes to realize that all three cases have blended into a single deadly conundrum. If you like your whiskey blended, if you like your adventures blended, you might want to check out Unquiet Spirits. But in the meantime, let's check out this conversation with Bonnie McBird. Bonnie, welcome to the show, or should I say welcome back?
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, the last time we saw you around these parts, I think it was episode 83 of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, when we talked with you about your other Sherlock Holmes novel, Art in the Blood.
Yes.
If I recall correctly, I believe you already had it in your plans to start on Unquiet Spirits while you were talking with us during your Art in the Blood tour. Does that timing sound about right?
Yes, it does. Yes, I had to start right away on them. They take a long time to do, actually.
So how did that come about? How did you decide as soon as you were done with Art in the Blood that Unquiet Spirits was next up? Where was the inspiration?
Well, the first of all, the inspiration came from, I decided to set it in the following year. So Art in the Blood was 1888. So Unquiet Spirits is going to be set a year later in the winter of 1889. So I started perusing the newspapers of that year and just kind of looking at what was going on and sort of the general trends and various things. And I came across some articles on the decimation of the French vineyards by the phylloxera epidemic, which was a little parasite that had been brought in inadvertently to France around the 1860s. But by the late 1880s, it was dire, and I think something like 45% of the vineyards had been destroyed. So, as a non sequitur, someone had introduced me to a really good whiskey, which is the first good whiskey I'd ever had in my life. And it was a Glenmorangie Quinta Riban, which is the first one. And, I really liked whiskey. And then I read that the whiskey industry sort of making great strides in London at that time. So suddenly something to do with whiskey and the wine industry just started to float around as a possible area of interest. And then, of course, the word spirits and its double meaning came to me and so forth. But that really wasn't enough. because I really conceived of these two novels, and in fact have also on the third one that I'm working on now, by taking kind of a dual approach. One is, you know, the current events of the time, and the other is I wanted to each of them to express kind of a theme. So I start with theme, and as I was fishing around with Unquiet Spirits, it occurred to me that a theme pertaining to ghosts that interested me was what happens if you don't deal with the ghosts of your past. We know Sherlock Holmes must have them because he's some kind of slightly damaged character. I mean, we know he's celibate for a reason. And so what are his ghosts? You know, this is something that's very interesting. At the same moment I had that thought, I also thought, well, don't want to reveal too much or make up too much because the mystery is part of what we love about him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all kind of fill it in. So it came from a combination of finding the theme and finding kind of some interesting thing that was going on in 1889.
Can we talk a little bit more about that interesting thing that's going on in 1889? Was the epidemic and its effect on the vineyards in France, was that really a national calamity?
Yes, actually it was, although the political implications of it that I put in the book are completely made up. As far as I know, at least I've never read anything that it was considered to be industrial sabotage. But why not? I mean, it could have been, you know. The French wine industry is very closely tied into France's self-image. I mean, it's really, it's very important to the French. And it was truly, truly hampered. Brandy and wine, anything grape-based was suddenly very dear and costly. And they were just really upended by this. So, yes, it was a big deal to them.
When I first read that in Unquiet Spirits, because in the opening first part of the book, which is organized in six parts, which pattern the maturation of a great spirit. I was interested in that structure. But when we first encounter Holmes at home in 1889, there is a brandy shortage in London. And yeah. I was immediately struck by how many people were probably falling like flies, you know, into the funeral home without the medicinal effects of Watson's brandy, the universal specific. Yeah.
Yes, it's so funny in the books how brandy is, you know, administered for everything. You know, you're feeling faint, you're upset, you know, you've had a chill, but you're bleeding to death. Here, have some brandy.
Yeah. I'll drink to that.
Yeah, I'll drink to that too. But was that, and you chart it right around the time when there seems to be growing awareness and interest in Scotch whiskey in Usquebaugh, where, you know, when you bring up all these wonderful names and origins. Is that true that that before 1889, you know, a good Scottish malt was not high on people's, you know, regular tipple?
That is correct. It was known and it was drunk. In fact, it's mentioned several times in the canon, not frequently. It was always drunk with soda. But the thing about it is that prior to the end of the 1880s, whiskey, as we know it, what was called single malt now was called then self whiskey. Mm. And it was a much sharper, more pungent, intense flavor. And it was pretty much drunk only by guys out hunting and fishing, you know, from a flask. It was a manly man's drink, and it wasn't really so much drunk in society. And there were several reasons. One is that the taste of that didn't really suit the London palate so much. And another reason was that they these are all products of little personal distilleries, little, you know, random ones dotted around the countryside. And they didn't have consistency. They had small batches and relatively low consistency. So they couldn't sell, you know, Johnny Walker that would always taste the same because they didn't have any way to keep the consistency. But with the Industrial Revolution, a whole bunch of things changed, including the railroads allowing them to gather up a bunch of whiskey all in one place and sort of put it in a mixture and create a large batch that had consistent flavor. There's a whole bunch of changes that happened right then. But what happened when the phylloxera epidemic really made other spirits more costly, is the whiskey marketers marched into London with the plan of setting up their drink as the new drink of society. So bolstered by this, having, you know, these blends now that were kind of softer tasting and easier to introduce and also could be consistent. So bolstered by this, they were able to make these remarkable inroads, but also because this group of people, and they were led by like Buchanan and Tommy Dewar, and these guys basically invented modern marketing. And there's very funny stories about some of the stuff they did.
And how did you research all this? I mean, it's a wonderful topic, so I can imagine how excited you were to say, "Hey, let's learn more about this." But did you sort of dive into the British Museum? Did you spend a lot of time in Scotland? How did you acquire all this knowledge and insight?
Well, I usually start with the path of least resistance, which, of course, online. And then once I sort of sniff something out, that there's something fertile, there's clues there, whatever, I then go to the library. And so I did spend quite a bit of time at the British Library. And then I very quickly sort of sought out and made friends with a man who's the foremost Scotch whiskey expert in the world. His name is Charlie McLean. He's written, I don't know, 30 books on the topic. And I started consulting with him and telling him of my intentions and asking him for suggestions on where to location scout, where to begin. Because, I mean, it's a pretty vast field. And he actually suggested some distilleries to visit. So, you know, it was a tough job, right? Someone had to do it. So
You should have told us you were going. We would have gone with you.
I know. I think I'm going to have like a book related tour or something, bring people
idea.
Because I had so much fun on this. So the first one, you know, I usually start, like I said, with the path of least resistance. So I went, you know, I was in Edinburgh to meet with this man and we became friends and he became the consultant on the book. Anyway, so the first distillery I visited was just outside, it was Glenkinchie, just outside of Edinburgh. And, you know, I started to get a feel for the process. In fact, you're right, the six sections of the book are named after the stages of whiskey making. And I started to get a feel. And then I realized location scouting for a book is different than location scouting for a movie. It's somewhat similar in that you get a lot of you get a lot of local detail that ends up in the piece. Location scouting for a movie, you usually know what you want before you get there, and then you're looking for that thing. But location scouting for a book is, I didn't really know what the scenes were yet. I just knew that I was going to be in and around a distillery. And so it was kind of like when I saw things that's, you know, just suggested scenes or suggested moments or plot turns, this sort of thing, you know, just got my creative juices flowing. So I knew that I wanted to set this in the Highlands. I'd been to Scotland a bunch of times before, but never to the Highlands. So I made a trip up there. And I had in mind in one of the earlier drafts, I was going to have something to do with Balmoral, which I didn't actually end up putting in the book, although there is a visit from the royal family, from one of the lesser members of the royal family to the distillery in question. So I went up to that area in order to get to Balmoral at that time, and still even. But what you did is you took a train up from London to Edinburgh to Aberdeen, and then you took a train across to Ballater, and then there was a special private train that went to Balmoral. Apparently, Queen Victoria was terrified of this train because they made it so efficient, it went too fast, and it scared her. Anyway, she didn't like to take the train. But anyway, so that's how you would get there. So I visited Royal Lochnagar, which is the second distillery, and that one is right near Balmoral. And in fact, it had the royal warrant from Queen Victoria. It was her family's distillery, or at least was the distillery that provided whiskey for her family. So I had a wonderful tour there, and I knew that that was the area I wanted to set up the locale for the castle that that would appear in the book. That would be the main location of the mystery. So I started location scouting up there and found this wonderful castle that had exactly what I needed, which was, it was a medieval castle that had been built on generation after generation with different weird sections of it. But it had been redecorated in the Victorian era, and then that stuff had all been left. So it was, you know, it was kind of the thing. Now, I used that as kind of a model, although I did, you know, go off on it somewhat. I made mine a bit grander, bigger and grander than the one I saw. It was Castle Fraser was the one I got excited about up there, but inspired by it. So like I said, sometimes these things, you know, I didn't know what to expect when I went there. I was just going to gather ambience. But while I was there, I saw the ice house, which they had, and that inspired a whole sequence in the book, which I hadn't been thinking of until I saw the thing. And also, just there's a couple of other things, including a spy device, which is, I don't want to give it away, but it's in the book. That was also in Castle Fraser. And it's another one that exists in the Edinburgh Castle, and I think four others in Scotland as well. So that was kind of fun. So then I visited a couple more distilleries, and then I was told by my consultant, Charlie McLean, that there is a distillery on the island of Isla, which is spelled Islay, I-S-L-A-Y, but it's Isla, and that's in the Hebrides. And this distillery, which is called Bruichladdy, uses the Victorian equipment. It's still extant. It's still in use. And I thought, oh, I got to see that. So I went there. That was kind of way out of the way and rather hard to get to. But while I was there, of course, you know, the big stills they're still made of copper. But, you know, in the Victorian era, the big rivets on them, they look like Jules Verne spaceships. And they're really fun. It's so atmospheric. And distilleries are kind of a scary, you know, very intense places to work, full of steam and things, you know, big fires going places to run steam engines and vapors that you can, you know, you can die from inhaling, and big hot vats of steaming, bubbling stuff and big rakes churning through them and, you know, grinding machines, all kinds of, you know, danger exists there. And I saw this stuff and I'm like, yeah, major adventure has to happen here. You know, it got me very excited. So that was kind of fun. And that came in fairly early in the process, this getting inspired by actually what was in these places.
Yeah.
So you
mentioned earlier about ghosts of the past and how little we really know about Sherlock Holmes's past. And in this case, we have an opportunity to delve into his school days a little bit. And I would imagine one of your other scouting locations was Fettes. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, that's actually Fettes.
Fettes, okay.
Fettes, yeah.
Tell us a Fettes, little bit about that.
A college is, you know, what we would call like a high school, a private high school. It's pre-university, and it still exists. And in fact, it is a place that came into existence just when Holmes would have been about 16 or so. So he could only have attended maybe his last year of schooling before university. It was started as a foundation school. It's a really interesting place. You know, I just saw it from the outside and I thought, oh my God, this is so weird and interesting looking. And of course, it is interesting looking. It's very Gothic. It's a strange mix of architectural types. And in fact, the exterior of this building is the model for Hogwarts.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I didn't know that when I picked it. There's several surprises that came along the way. But I started reading about it. And this book I got in the British Library, and was sitting there in the British Library reading this stuff, imagining Holmes at this place. It was founded as a foundation school, which means for poor kids. But I don't think he grew up as a poor kid. But it also took in wealthy paying kids, which I would imagine he would have been one, because we know one of the few things, of course, we know is that he's the son of country squires. So that implies a certain, you know, lifestyle, a certain degree of wealth. So he didn't come in as a foundation student, I didn't think. And he came in as a rich kid, parents paying for it. But this place had a very particular character to it. It was founded by a guy who wanted the boys, it was all boys, of course, at first, boys attending to be able to have a chance to be gentlemen. And so to form their characters, and this was very big at the end of the 19th century, they had to do a lot of rigorous sports. They had to play a lot of team sports. Individual sports were discouraged because they created ego, except for boxing. And the rest of them were all team sports. And can you imagine Holmes being, you know, trying to get him to play team sports? I don't think so. Maybe not a big fit. And plus they wanted to, they emphasized the classics and rhetoric and, you know, that sort of thing. And they disdained math and science, which would be another clash with his interests. They disdained these for the reason that those were like, those were not the activities of a gentleman. Those were the professions. Granted, the higher end professions, you know, professors and doctors and so forth. Nevertheless, those were professions, and so not what was needed. So he would have just like hated this place. And they had tremendous other all kinds of sort of disciplinary things they did. So for example, they this is in the book and this is real. At night they had little metal bathtubs in the dorm rooms, and they had to fill them with water. And then in the morning, they had to jump in and take a bath in them. But often at night, they would freeze. I mean, there would be a crust of ice on these on the water, and they were supposed to take their hairbrushes and break the ice and just get in. And so the whole thing would be so antithetical to Holmes's character. Yeah. He would just, you know, how would he maneuver through this school would be very interesting. So that's in there. And Fettes has a motto. It's called Industria. You know, it's sort of very moralistic in that end of the 19th century kind of way. Industria, you know, hardworking. But the logo is the honeybee. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, okay, this is the school. This is definitely the school. I got to tour the school. It was between terms. So my whiskey expert, Charlie McLean, and I got a tour. We got to go through the entire school, even into the dorm rooms. And I saw Victorian era graffiti in the dorm rooms. It was kind of fun. And we went all the way up into the rafters and where they store the luggage. And it's a very circuitous kind of layout. And it just seemed so ripe for an adventure there. So I pictured him. And one of the more poignant things I thought of is like, if he was so, he would so not fit in there. And he's such an iconoclast. He's such an individualist. And he surely would have been playing the violin by then because to be as good as he is. So we were taken into the chapel, and it had high vaulted ceilings and a beautiful acoustic in it. And so I thought he would come there in the middle of the night and practice his violin. I just had this image of him doing that. So it just kind of sort of, once I discovered it in a book in the British Library, and then I went there, like the whole, that whole sequence just kind of came alive for me. And it really felt right that he had been there briefly. I don't know. It's just a very interesting kind of strange school. So even now, it's co-ed, but they still have some of the same features. They still emphasize team sports, for example. But it's an interesting school. It's also James Bond's alma mater, and I didn't know that when I picked it.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
I like that.
I like that.
Everything I found out about it, the more I read, the more I discovered about it, the more it just seemed right. Like it was just falling into place.
Well, you could probably use the ice from the bathtubs for your Scotch whiskey too. So that's a
right.
So as you went on this journey, both physically and artistically, as you wrote the book, what surprises did you find?
Oh, my, so many surprises. I didn't realize really anything about how the whiskey industry became what it is today. I didn't know that it was unpopular before that, and how the marketing efforts basically transformed the way whiskey was thought of in the cities. So I didn't know any of that. I didn't really know about Fettes. I didn't have a clue that in Scotland, even where it's freezing up there in the winter, they imported ice from the Great Lakes, no less, in America. Queen Victoria got her ice from the Great Lakes. And Of course, then that became the chic thing to do. If the queen did it, you wanted that too. You're wealthy. And they would store this ice in these, you know, in these underground ice houses, the tops of which looked like little, you know, playhouses of children kind of half buried in the earth. They were just really weird little things. There were so many things that I really didn't know about. I also didn't realize that the whiskey making business has great lore attached to it. It's very much a culture. And the people who do it, it's a small kind of insular, feels like family, people that work in the industry. So in the island of Islay, for example, there are nine distilleries, and almost everyone on the island is either working in the whiskey business or in the tourist business that surrounds the whiskey business. And there is a rather touching story about Bruichladdich. That's the one that has the Victorian equipment still. They are now a thriving distillery and very well respected. But they went out of business some years ago, and then just lay the whole distillery just lay fallow and unused. And there was a rather famous whiskey man named Jim McEwen, who I also met and who consulted with me and gave me a wonderful idea for the story. And he's called the cask whisperer. the cask whisperer. Because of course, you know, the flavor of whiskey is very, very particular. And, you know, it has some people, you know, use that sort of, you know, arcane term, that sort of maybe snobby term, terroir, you know, about whiskey, which means basically that the characteristic of the flavor comes from a lot of things that go into it. It includes the type of barley, how it's dried, what is burned to make it dry, how much protein is in the grain, then how the fermenting process is done, how long it's done, the kind of water, where the water came from, and then the distilling process, the shape of the still, and how many times it goes through. And I mean, there's a million, and then the cask, then it's put into cask, and it's like the quality of the cask, what was in the cask before, how charred is the inside, what is the temperature in the warehouse, is it even or does it fluctuate, does it have sea breezes or does it have highland air, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, this huge list of things that go into the magic of the flavors of the whiskey. And so they, you know, that got really, really interesting. But this man who's the cask whisperer, the little story about Bruichladdich is this. Bruichladdich, as I said, was lying empty and fallow, and he was working, across the, I'm trying to remember which, was it Lagavulin? I think it was, or one of those. He was working at, and he'd been kind of the head distiller there. And he said in this very poignant interview that whiskey had suddenly taken center stage. And that's recent, too. You know, there's been a recent resurgence in popularity of single malt. So he said, all these other whiskey distilleries on Islay had their chance at the ball, come to the ball. But, you know, but Bruichladdich never got to go. It's like you didn't get to go to prom, you know. And he said, I wanted her to have a chance. So he went and he resurrected that distillery, and he rehired people who came back after 40 years and found their jackets and their aprons and things still hanging on the pegs where they left them.
Wow.
Oh. And they came back in and they resurrected this distillery. And now it's, you know, very viable and doing quite well. Mm-hmm. And that's the one with the, that's kind of a romantic story. And that's the one with the Victorian equipment in it. So anyway, that's kind of a sweet story. And it just gives you an idea of how emotional these guys are about their product. It's very personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's, you know, you described that very well. And one of the characteristics of unquiet spirits is that you make the most of this landscape, this history, this complexity, and also the deep emotions in it. In the book, you spend time connecting strange, puzzling events today to things that happened in the past. What's your feeling about all that, and how did you lay in the exploration of Holmes' past to it as well? Because that's obviously a key point of this book.
Well, Britt, that's a really good question, because I knew early on in the writing process that facing a ghost from his past, this is metaphorically speaking now, would have to happen before he could solve the present day mystery. That was just kind of an idea without reality to it that I just had in my head. I knew that I wanted that to happen. I didn't know the detail of it or how that was going to happen. I do know that in both books, in both Art in the Blood and Unquiet Spirits, I found that I had to create rather complex plots. In fact, in both of them, there are three different mysteries which kind of convolve together like a triple helix, and he has to kind of solve them all together. And I found that necessary to do because Holmes is so smart that if it isn't that complicated, he'd be done by page 30, you know, and it'd be a short story. I mean, then that's, you know, that's the form that we are used to, and that's what Conan Doyle generally did. So, but to extend that out to a novel, it needed to have some of this slightly different construction. So early on, I decided that this kind of intellectual idea, he had to, you know, face a ghost from his past. I didn't know what that ghost was. I didn't know why facing it or how facing it would help anything in the present day. I had no clue. And I wrote blind for quite a while on this book, which is sort of what I did on Art in the Blood and what I'm doing now in the third book, The Devil's Due, which is I have these feelings about where different things that have to happen in the story, and I know they connect, but I don't yet know how they connect. And I have to trust my instinct to weave them together. And so sometimes that requires reverse engineering, and sometimes it just requires big creative leaps. It's hard to describe exactly, but I usually have kind of an overarching idea before I know how I'm going to make it work.
It's kind of like a sixth sense, it sounds like.
It is kind of. I have to stay relaxed and focused in a way. It's really not unlike solving a crime, I think. I mean, it's you different things become really clear and apparent, and you get like all these clues in a way, and then you have to create the narrative that connects the clues in a sensible way. Of course, the difference being that I can alter the clues. You know, it's not like Holmes can't say, well, these footprints really should be over here to make my narrative work. I can move the footprints. But you know what I'm saying? So in that sense, it's different than solving a crime. But it is similar in that you see all these disparate tiny things and you know they connect or they need to connect. And then you kind of try on these kind of crystalline, complicated patterns to see if they connect that way or not.
That's wonderful. So when you're doing that, I mean, how many iterations do you have to go through to really hone the final product that we as readers see?
Oh, my God. some chapters are probably written 12, 15 times.
Wow.
And some maybe two or three, but never less than three.
Wow.
It's a lot of work. I know there are people that write much more quickly than this. And I know Conan Doyle wrote very quickly. And I have been able to write short stories a lot faster than this. But this particular kind of structure, for me, just takes a really long time. Now, what comes easily to me is the character bits. To me, it's so natural, the stakes that are there between for the friendship, for example. Those just come out like they're, you know, like I'm channeling it or so. I don't know exactly. They just are so vivid and so clear, and those generally don't get terribly rewritten. What is really hard to do, and this is something that Moffat and Gatiss actually said also when they were interviewed about writing Sherlock. I attended, by the way, a conference in London not too long ago, which was held by a screenwriters group, and really asked them a lot of questions about their writing. And so basically it's the character stuff is in many ways the easier part. And what's really, really hard is to make the mysteries work and then make their characters fit into those mysteries. But writing the clues and so that Sherlock Holmes picks up before you do, but you're not stupid and Watson isn't stupid. And so you Conan Doyle did not reveal everything, though. There's I forget who it was that created the rules of mystery writing that say, you know, everything should be on the page and so the reader can have figured it out themselves. Well, Conan Doyle doesn't actually do that.
Yeah.
He puts quite a bit on the page, but really not all of it. And many times Holmes will go off and off camera, so to speak. He will find stuff and then later reveal it, you know, as, you know, it is a little bit of a rabbit out of a hat. So, you know, I felt a little bit of freedom to at least follow Conan Doyle's lead here. And however, if you don't give the reader enough, it's a cheat and it's frustrating for the reader. So that question of when to reveal each clue and when to, you know, provide that inkling of, uh-oh, I think it's this. And when you can be wrong and when you can be right, that stuff, it's like choreography.
Yeah.
And that is the stuff I would tinker with endlessly until it felt right. So that stuff got really, really worked.
Well, you know, one of the things that most people, I'm sure everybody listening to this, enjoys about the cases of Sherlock Holmes is that there's always that wonderful moment where he does something truly surprising. You know, he exercises his powers to the astonishment of the people that he's surrounded by. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about a couple of those moments in this book and how you sort of went about that?
Sure. There are several. You have to deliver on that, otherwise you've not fulfilled the promise, right? I mean, that is one of the key things you have to deliver. So one of the funny ones is relatively near the front when he's invited to a dinner, thinking that he's going to be presented with a case, and instead he's actually invited to be the entertainment and to, you know, reveal, you know, like a magician. And you know, he tries to talk them out of that, but. Anyway, so there's a moment there, and that was quite fun to figure out how he would, and it would be a combination, as it was with Doyle, where he's done homework, because Holmes always does homework. He also is encyclopedic in his knowledge, so he knows the peerage, he reads the papers, he knows all that stuff. But then he has to, like, pull stuff from what he's seeing right on the spot. So I combined those two things with some very fun revelations at that dinner party. And then another time, of course, is when he is figuring out the two young people have died, and it's a rather gruesome discovery of their bodies. But he figures out from a number of features of what's going on with the bodies exactly what happened. And I think that's another example of that. So, I mean, I think those are – and. I mean, there's several other things. I don't want to give away too much, but I do realize you have to deliver on that promise.
And one of the nice things that you've done in Unquiet Spirits is that you've created a completely original character, someone who is sort of Irene Adler on steroids, you know, very much an equal to Holmes without giving too much away. Can you talk a little bit about Miss McLaren?
Yeah, I think, without making too much of a point of it, I don't want to read a book without an interesting female character myself. So I put her in for, you know, because that's what's interesting to me. So she, you know, she's a bit of a mystery at the beginning, and as she should be. And I like writing smart characters, smart female characters, well, all characters really, but particularly. And so she just marched onto the page, and she came off a little tougher than I thought she was going. She just kind of took on a persona that it kind of took on a life of its own. And I think that you are not really sure which side of the, you know, of good and evil she's on, which is as it should be, because she, you know, there's a very complex history there, which eventually is revealed. And I think, so she was quite fun for me. I also had a female doctor in there who was a bit of a surprise. I just try to create characters that are interesting to me and hopefully to the reader. So the other thing is you don't want everybody to be exactly what they appear right off the bat.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you really want to hook attention and keep them going. And, you know, one of the things, a couple of things that struck me about this is the length of the book. We're coming up on 500 pages for this.
Yep.
And this is supposedly one of those lost manuscripts of Watson that never made it to the public's eye. Watson's longest manuscript that did reach the public eye was The Hound of the Baskervilles at about 250 pages. Why was he so verbose in this one?
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, if you find him verbose, that sounds like he's wordy moment by moment.
Well, let me qualify that. Why would an adventure that is, and literally, let's say series of adventures, why would a tale that is so full of adventure not ever make it to the public's eye?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, he does sort of mention something in the very beginning. This one didn't, because it reveals a bit about Holmes's youthful things that he might not want revealed about himself as a student, something kind of unhappy in his past. So I think, you know, he doesn't reveal it because, you know, he promised not to for 50 years or whatever after his death. So, and then it just got lost. It basically got put away, and then it wasn't that. This is the conceit. I mean, we are playing the game, right? So, so that is the thought behind this, is that he, you know, he really didn't want the Fetus and university story out.
So that really gets to some of that, the character and the characterization that you talk about, that at the very base of this and of the canon is this wonderful friendship between Holmes and Watson, and a sense that each protects the other in a way that he knows how. And
yes,
that's really Watson's way of protecting Holmes, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think like most Holmes fans and also those who are writing, I think the friendship is probably the cornerstone of these stories, even more so than the mysteries. And so I think, you know, that the exploration of their relationship is always of interest to me. So, and, you know, they don't get along on every point, which is fun. and I have a rather large schism here that, or it appears to be larger than it is, possibly. Hmm. I have to say, though, that in my head, I don't know if this will be a spoiler or not. In my head, that moment, that break between them, is not unlike the note at the Reichenbach, which is, you know, they need to go back and because, you know, whatever. It's more protecting him. But, you know, in my head, see, several people have complained to me, like, oh, they would never get this, fight this hard, or you know, he would never do this. And I'm thinking, well, he sort of did exactly that at the Reichenbach. But that isn't so explicit in there. But to me, it is a consistency of the fact that they care very much for each other.
Yeah.
You know, that's just one of the heart and soul things that I love about the characters. That's why, kind of why I like to spend time with them, really.
Yeah. I think that's apparent in the final product and in the way you talk about it. And you're certainly getting an opportunity now to talk with people about this as you're out on the book tour. Where has your tour taken you? Where are you going?
So far I've been to, it came out in England first, because my publisher, HarperCollins, it's the London office that publishes these books. And so it comes out there first. So I did some stuff up there. I did, London and Edinburgh primarily. And then I did a show at the Fringe actually with my whiskey expert friend. We did a ghost called Whiskey Ghosts and Sherlock Holmes. We gave samples of whiskey and talked about ghosts in Scotland and how they relate to the story.
Oh, I like that.
And we did it at the Arthur Conan Doyle Center, which is a center for research on spiritualism.
How appropriate.
Yeah, I know. We did it in the Sherlock Holmes Tea Room at the Arthur Conan Doyle Center. And of course, they believe really in ghosts there. They are actually studying them. That's what they do there. You know, and so I don't personally believe in ghosts like that. But as my friend Charlie McLean said, the question isn't, do you believe in ghosts? The question really should be, do people see ghosts? And of course, the answer is yes. We don't know what they're seeing, but they're seeing something. So anyway, that gets very interesting. But anyway, so London and Edinburgh there. And then, hear this, I got sick on my book tour and I still have it. So I then went to BoucherCon at Toronto, which is where it was released in the States. I did some signings and stuff. And then I did, let's say I went to Houston and Murder by the Book, Phoenix, which was Poison Pen, of course. And then, let's see, I was going to do Chicago Centuries and Sleuths, but I had to cancel for illness, but I'm going there next week instead. Mm. And then I did, let's see, Indiana, and I did a couple of things. I did a bookstore and then a Sherlockian meeting. That was quite fun. Then let's see, what did I do? I can't remember now. But anyway, a couple more, ending in, then there was, the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, which was quite fun. We had a very good turnout there. And then I did D.C. And then after D.C., I came here where I am right now, which is in Lenox, Massachusetts at the moment. So I'm just kind of resting and recovering. and then I'm going to do Chicago and L.A.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
And I suppose we would be remiss if we didn't mention the wonderful kind of companion site that you've set up. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes with notes to the book.
Yes, annotations.
Annotations, yeah. And I think you did this with Art in the Blood as well. We were impressed with that. So if you want annotations for Unquiet Spirits, check out our show notes, or you can find them on macbird.com as well.
Hmm. And Bonnie, what about your art? Are there any illustrations of Unquiet Spirits completed or afoot?
Well, they're afoot, Bert. I wasn't going to do them, but then I don't know, there's something, I just really decided I wanted to. So I have, in fact, set up a photo shoot. I did, in New York, I shot Catherine. I shot a lovely model for Catherine. And in LA in a couple of weeks, I'm going to shoot all the photos that I use for reference. So I cast it and set up the shoot already. Had to, you know, I have to rent costumes. Like, you know, Sidney Paget did not have to rent costumes. It's a little bit more complicated. But he did very much the same thing, which is basically cast his friends. In my case, I have a lot of actor friends, and which is good because they don't just stand there. By the way, I'm in Lenox, Massachusetts right now, and I recently visited the Norman Rockwell Museum. And, you know, he was a great illustrator. He worked entirely from photographs, and also, as many of the illustrators, including Paget, did. I have a wonderful book which I bought there of how he worked from the photographs and how he posed them and how he found some of his he used friends and neighbors because he wasn't in the theater. And there was this one little boy who was so good at being expressive. You know, he could say, look jealous, look like you're making fun of this kid, look like you're angry, look like you're pouting, look like you're really, really sad. And the kid was fabulous. And these pictures are remarkable. So he sometimes used the same kid for a bunch of different people in the same picture. But I have this wonderful thing that the people who are modeling for me are actors. And so I'm really excited to work with them. So, in fact, I've just picked out some of the illustrations that I'm going to be doing for that.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, if folks are interested, the book is Unquiet Spirits, Whiskey, Ghosts, Murder by Bonnie McBird. It is available from HarperCollins. Of course, available pretty much anywhere you can get books, whether your purveyor of choice is your local mystery shop, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it. It is a thorough and wonderful read about some of the early days of Holmes and Watson. Bonnie, thank you so much for being with us once again.
Oh, what a pleasure. It's always fun to talk to you.
Well, it's a great tale, and it's wonderful to have the opportunity to see Holmes and Watson in some unfamiliar places, particularly the south of France, which is a lovely part of the world that until this very moment we had no idea they'd ever visited, as well as the intriguing environments of Scotland.
Yeah. Which that the Scottish section of the tale reminded me a bit of the private life of Sherlock Holmes. You know, Watson and Holmes finding themselves up around Loch Ness. And, of course, there was a visit from Queen Victoria there as well.
So, excellent.
But, yeah, check that out. Well, in the meantime, you got to check out these guys. The magic of the Baker Street Journal isn't that it's been published for 70-plus years. It isn't that it's entirely volunteer-driven either. The magic of the Baker Street Journal is that it fills a need in the Sherlockian universe. Because we have an intellectual curiosity that leaves us wanting more after we close the pages of the canon. Because we must know more about Sherlock Holmes's childhood, or about train timetables in Victorian times, or the inspiration for the Diogenes Club, or the official location of 221B Baker Street. Yes, we are creatures of knowledge who seek more information about our pastime, and the BSJ provides it. But the real magic of the Baker Street Journal is that the articles and artwork that appear in it are entirely fan-created. The reason that the BSJ can continue to publish after 7 decades is because of the passion, creativity, and tireless efforts by devotees of Sherlock Holmes worldwide. And it doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon. Now's the time to get on board or to renew your subscription. Visit BakerStreetJournal.com and be part of that magic today. Hey, we mentioned at the top of the show the ability to donate to the tip jar. And for those of you that use Patreon, which is our preferred method of choice for having you contribute to the show, that which you find worthwhile. For our patrons, we are going to do a drawing. If you have given us $5 or more a month, your name goes into a drawing, and the lucky winner will actually get a copy of Bonnie's book. And we will be doing this with regularity on episodes going forward. We will be doing giveaways. So if you are interested in getting some tchotchkes, getting some Sherlockian books or other ephemera, get on over to patreon.com/IHearOfSherlock, or just hit that orange button right on our website and put your name and your contribution in there, and you'll be entered to win. Good luck. Well, you know, just a couple of closing notes here as we toddle toward the end of November. At the time of recording here, we were just greeted with the death of John Hillerman, unfortunately.
Oh, yes.
Remember him, of course, from Magnum P.I. as Higgins, but his Sherlockian connections were interesting. He played Watson to Holmes in The Hands of a Murderer. Edward Woodward was a questionable Holmes. Yes, oddly cast at best. But Hillerman played a decent Watson, I thought.
Yeah, Edward Woodward received the Stuart Granger Award for Holmes portrayals.
That's wonderful. Well, and here's an offbeat connection too. As Watson is Holmes's Boswell, and Boswell, of course, was the great biographer to Samuel Johnson. You may recall that John Hillerman was in Blazing Saddles. And you may or may not recall this sly inference to Boswell.
Reverend, Dr. Samuel Johnson's right about Olson Johnson's being right. And I'm not giving up my ice cream parlor that I built with these two hands for nothing or nobody.
Howard Johnson is right.
Good old Howard Johnson referencing Samuel Johnson. Got it everywhere. Well, so that's worth it. And the other thing we talked about recently is, get your seatbelts ready for this. Sherlock Gnomes is coming to theaters as the sequel to Gnomeo and Juliet. To me, it's certainly not a mainstream thing. It's one of these things that's fun for the kids. And look, if it gets the kids interested in more mainstream Sherlock Holmes, then hey, we're all better off for it. So Sherlock Holmes coming in flavors, in sizes, in forms of all kinds. And that's what we do here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, until next time, I will remain in this shape and form as Scott Monty.
And I am committed to remain completely formless as Bert Wilder.
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.